Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and get started with the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today, we have six bills that were actually in informational hearing mode on the 1st of February, which was this past Wednesday. They're back here today for public hearing and possible work session. What I'm going to do is go out of order because one of the bills we've decided and determined that we're not going to be moving it forward, but I think it's important that we put on the record some of the background and where we are at and why we are going to be moving that bill into the interim for additional work and in a work group setting. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and call a public hearing on Senate Bill 1526. Bill?
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 1526, and you'll hear more about this from Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, is intended to address the case of Demdy versus Handy Sorensen. And what it attempts to do is define deliberation for the purposes of a public body in an open meeting.
Okay, thank you. So what we're going to do is first I want to ask Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel, to please come forward. He's going to kind of give us an overview, and there was a legislative opinion that he, his office put out during the last session. That was kind of the predicate for myself as chair to be looking at this issue as a committee bill for this short session. And I will put on the record that when I had the bill drafted, based on the drafting, it had some, let's say, areas of concern from different people. What we knew we had to do if we were going to maintain the bill for consideration in this session, that we needed to introduce it as it was drafted because of the shortness in time to try to get it redrafted. With that said, it was in fact done, but it was intended from that purpose that we were not going to be moving forward unless we had consensus for a larger, broader work group that actually included members of interested parties, including representatives of the public, specifically the Newspaper Publishers Association, as well as the ACLU, as well included. So with that, what I'm going to do is basically first state that we will not be moving this bill forward today, but what we are going to do, as I said in the intro, put a few things on the record, and I've asked, again, Dexter to please come forward and kind of give us an overview as to where we're at, as to why we're here, and what was requested of LC. And with that, Dexter, if you'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Counsel. And I think to begin, what I'd like to do is just give you a 30-second overview of the basic concept of the public meetings law. And what that law requires essentially is that a governing body of a public body must meet in a meeting that is open for members of the public at large to attend. The linchpin of the public meetings law is the idea that whenever a quorum of the governing body gathers for the purpose of deliberating towards a decision, that gathering is a public meeting and therefore must be noticed and conducted in a place where the public is invited to attend and observe. The case, Mr. Chair, that you mentioned, Demdy versus Handy, is a circuit court decision in Lane County that considered the circumstances of how the Lane County Board of Commissioners, a five-member governing body, adopted a supplemental budget for, I believe, the 2009-2010 fiscal year. And in that, the court observed first that there was, in the process leading up to the adoption of the budget as an entirety, there was a substantial amount of facts where commissioners and staff would gather and discuss in not in a quorum, that is to say, not where there was three or more commissioners in the same room, but a lot of meeting of less than a quorum of commissioners and staff to discuss the Lane County budget. The Lane County budget was duly adopted in time for the start of the fiscal year and was not really directly at issue in the case because of a 60-day statute of limitations that applies to challenges based on violations of the public meetings law. However, the court noted that the same pattern of facts emerged when the commission considered the supplemental budget decision in December of that year. And essentially there was the facts that the court found concerning were fall into two categories. Email exchanges between less than a quorum of commissioners in which budget issues were discussed, and meetings, one-on-one meetings between commissioners or in which a staff member is used as an intermediary, also in which budget issues were discussed. And the court essentially concluded that those amounted to deliberations that constituted a violation of the public meetings law when those communications occurred after the meeting had been noticed. In other words, after the date on which the meeting had been posted on an official agenda. One-on-one meetings or email discussions that occurred after that date and before the date of the formal meeting where the supplemental budget was adopted 9 days later constituted, in the court's views, a violation of the public meetings law. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions for Dexter? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dexter, on this proposed amendment, I'm assuming you've seen this, the dash one.
Mr. Chair.
Dash two,
yes.
Yeah. That appears to, the wording of that amendment, after reading the judge's decision, Judge Gillespie's decision, and I'm certainly not an attorney, but it would seem that this amendment would categorically make legal exactly the conduct and actions that Judge Gillespie found to be willful violations of the public meeting standards.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, this amendment would modify the public meetings law to make that conduct not a violation of public meetings.
Yeah, thank you. And then also a comment. We were talking about emails and so forth in the last meeting, and also in that discussion, the judge says that without regard to how email communications transpire electronically, essentially, he says in the context of this case before the court, this court is satisfied that a continued search for a bright line rule is a fool's errand. And basically what he's saying, as I understood his decision, was if the email is immediately returned, you're having a dialogue, and if it's 2 weeks later, you're really not having a real-time dialogue, and the fool's errand is trying to determine where between immediately and 2 weeks out that bright line is.
No, and I agree, and that's, I think, what you're going to hear from the next panel is some of those concerns as to knowing that you're not going to be able to have a bright line, you're going to have a gray area, but what we're wanting to do and what my goal was to have some clarification as to under current means of communication that were not available when the law was adopted in the 70s, what can we do to give some guidance so people understand what more than likely is going to be acceptable and permissible under the public meeting law as compared to where you're getting into either over the line or getting close to it. So individuals that are serving not only in elected positions but also that have been appointed for different boards, commissions, budgets, that they're not going to find themselves in the in the situation of being accused of violating the state law where they were just trying to communicate some information to someone else. And so that's part of the difficulty, shortness of a session, and that's why we will not be moving this bill forward.
Yeah. I appreciate that explanation. The As I read the judge's decision, the emails really had nothing to do with his decision. He made it pretty clear. It wasn't the emails. It was the other behavior that, my words, not his, is characterized sort of as musical chairs to keep from having a quorum that he, I think he found to be willful misconduct. But that's... Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you've had a chance to review the opinion that's come from Legislative Council on the judge's opinion. If you haven't, we will make sure you get a copy of that, because I will tell you, based on that opinion, it appears that there could have been a reaching on the part of the court to come to the conclusion that it did. My perspective is that when you have, and we're going to get some of the scenarios coming up, so maybe we'll wait for those, but the bottom line is... it appeared for me his view was serial meetings that occurred that caused and established a quorum, even though you didn't have a quorum at one time together meeting. And that's part of the stuff I think we need to clarify, because knowing with electronic communications, it's very easy to be able to make the insinuation that if an email goes from individual one to individual two, and then there's continuation to other people, somehow that ties all of them together where they may not have been all together. But clearly you can have nuances where you have everyone getting the same email at the same time, all emailing back, which would. And that's, I think, the part that you're referring to, trying to draw a bright line is going to be extremely difficult, and we're not here to do that.
Good. Thank you.
Dexter, thank you very much. I don't think there's any other questions. With that, I have one panel, Paul Snyder, Tom Gallagher, and Scott Winkle, please come forward. And gentlemen, whoever would like to get started, please give us your name and proceed.
I'm Tom Gallagher. I represent the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. Having been involved in some work groups put together by the chair on this, we recognize the problem of creating a bright line in terms of what constitutes a public meeting. That said, we are committed to working with the chair and with these representatives of local government to try and determine a better clarity for local officials so that they can do their business. Our interests are, to delineate them a little bit, we want to see deliberations of public bodies conducted in public. We hope that we can achieve more clarity for elected officials in terms of what they can do and what they can say, and that is something that we will be spending some time, a great deal of time, I'm afraid, over the interim on. That we want to make sure that all methods of communications are considered, because emerging technologies allow different ways of doing business. And we are committed to seeing that government, when we're done, is able to operate efficiently and effectively. I think in this situation, the newspapers and the ACLU and others are looking at this from the general public side, and we expect that we'll be able to reach a compromise with local governments to come to some better clarity on this situation.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. First, I would like to thank the chair for convening the work group. We understand that this is a complicated piece of the statute that has a long and storied tradition in the state, and I would also like to thank my colleague, Mr. Gallagher, for his openness and reasonableness to this conversation. I will note that the Dumdye decision has had a cooling impact on dialogues between city officials. There is a certain nervousness between them, amongst them, the line was not clear before, but it has certainly become more muddled now. What the League would be seeking is a statute that would provide, as we say, it is. The judge notes it may be a fool's errand, it's probably not my first, but we would like to find a clear way to provide guidance to volunteer city officials so they can have conversations, they can engage in dialogue, but not deliberation, and there's no fear of a complicated gotcha moment where they could find themselves inadvertently in front of the an enforcement body. We have a number of issues, so for instance, that we are concerned about under the Dumdye decision. So, for instance, if we have a city council touring a, as we recently had, a flood area, and they look at an area that needs mitigation, and one of them says, "We need to do something about that." Have we established some sort of? Is that an action? Is that a deliberation? These are the sorts of issues that our counselors are considering right now, and it is having a, as I say, a cooling impact on those conversations. And again, we would just like a clear way to advise our city councilors on what they can and cannot do and still keep the spirit of the open meetings law. And with that, I'm eager for your questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Before the Dumdye decision was reached, we used to give trainings, we still give trainings, but they're not the same as they were before that decision, to county commissioners and county officials on what constitutes a public meeting. In those trainings, we've employed or used veteran county councils to give that piece of the training, and what they have said in the past that is that a gathering of less than a quorum is not a public meeting. The Attorney General's Public Meeting and Records Manual, previous to this decision, said the same thing. What they didn't address is what happens in the event of an exchange of emails that Senator Przanski has just described and that Dexter Johnson described. This was a circuit court opinion in one circuit. It was not an appellate court opinion. So what weight do you give to a circuit court opinion that ultimately resulted in a judgment of settlement of the case? And if I were to identify, if there is a consensus out there, I'd say the consensus in one word is some. You give it some weight. How much weight depends on a number of things, including how careful your county council is and trying to keep your commissioners completely out of trouble. But the outcome has been that a number of commissioners in a number of jurisdictions are very concerned about discussing county business anywhere other than in a public meeting setting, including when their office is right next door to somebody else's office, and the problem is exacerbated, as you've already discussed the other day, in a three-member county governing body, when two people having a conversation together is a quorum. Any conversation between those two people who are members of the county governing body is a quorum. And I think Senator Whitsitt put it well, and it's a common practice among three-member county governing bodies that they do not carpool anywhere. It's also, I think, common, as Senator Cruz described, if a commissioner wants to know what another commissioner thinks about an issue in a three-member county governing body, they send their staff over to talk to the other commissioner. When we began this process, when this bill was introduced, we sent out emails to a number of county attorneys, and I said, look, this is your chance to give us examples that you want some clarification on. Tell us what are the circumstances, give us an example, we'll do something, we'll see if we can reach consensus in the work group, bring it to the committee, and then we'll put it on the record, and that at least will give you some semblance of a red line. And it was rather interesting what some of the issues were. Mr. Winkles just described one where you have people who go out to a flood situation situation where there's a landfall or something, anything, where you have to go out to the site, you go with your public works director, what's it going to take to clear this road off, and you have a quorum sitting in the car. How far can you go in discussing what is the nature of the problem before you start to drift over in the direction of deliberating toward a decision? It's a very hard thing to do, and even if the county council is sitting there in the back seat, at some point they're going to drift into deliberation and they should have conducted a public meeting. That's the kind of problem that we're trying to avoid. Those results that I think any reasonable person would look at and say that's silly, That's absurd. We need to have government in a position where it does act in a way where the people who want to hear or know what's going on can find out. We agree with that. But we also need government to be able to act in an expeditious way so it doesn't have either a hogtied group of county governing body people or an inability to act in response to circumstances that just won't wait. And that, in the end, is one of the things that became very difficult for us as we got more and more into the weeds within the work group, and something that we'd like to address in more detail during the interim. So, Mr. Chair and members, I think that's all I have to say. I very much appreciate your attention.
All right, thank you. First, I want to see if there's any questions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put an example out here because this is one of the things that this work group looked at. And Senator Whitson, I'd like for you to give me your perspective just hearing this. You have a five-person board. Number A is the initiator of the conversations. A speaks to member two or B and then goes and speaks to number C, to member C. But B and C never talk to each other. The question is that somehow a meeting under the open meetings law where you have one individual who actually talks to two other individuals but separately and the other two never do?
You know, I'm not an attorney, so I'm at a disadvantage here, but reading Judge Gillespie's decision, it was sort of similar to that, and I think he predicated his decision on what the intent was the intent to actually circumvent the public meetings law, and secondly, did they in fact do so, and he found that they willfully did. It wasn't a matter of serendipitously he talked to she and she talked to he and then it came back around. That was the judge's decision. And so I guess the answer would be it depends.
Yeah, and to me it's one of those situations, you know, you got the serial, he's now introduced the term serial meetings, which is not something that we have had documented within the Oregon law. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I think is the frustration for government. And from my perspective, if you have one individual who has two separate distinct conversations from with other individuals on the same board, but those other two that they've discussed with have never had any discussion, it's hard for me to understand and rationalize how that becomes a meeting of three when you only had two at any time speaking and the two that were approached by one individual never spoke to each other. And so these are some of the complexities of what we're looking at, and we'll make certain. I thought you'd already received a copy of the Legislative Council opinion. I thought that was being delivered to you and everyone on this committee on Wednesday, and apparently it did not happen, so I will make certain that you do get it before the end of the day.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Because I think what it does and what LC did is under the existing laws and the interpretation of courts in the public meeting laws, and they found that their review based on the judge's ruling to the context of how it has been applied before, this was a unique interpretation of the public meetings law. So that's what we're trying to
Just for my own information, has Judge Gillespie's decision been appealed? And if not, is the window still open for that appeal?
Yeah, it has not. There was a settlement between the parties that occurred through negotiations with a arbitrating judge from the federal bench. And so that case is over. It's one of those things that, in fact, when I got the opinion from Legislative Council last spring, the caution was don't do anything until let's see if it goes up on appeal, because they felt that if it went up on appeal, the Court of Appeals would have come up with a different decision than what the trial court did. But it didn't, so we were kind of stuck there. Now, the other thing I will leave on, for everyone, is that everyone that's on this panel, I know, want and will continue to respect and ensure that the public meeting law is open and transparent. The question is, now that we have new technology that is now 30 years beyond when the law was written, how do we apply that standard to this communication? And that's what we will be working on during this interim. And so if others on this, if another member, I should say, of the committee is interested in working with the work group, so making certain we don't have a quorum of this committee, I will entertain that. So if someone wants to approach me, we will see if we can get that done. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to make any comments today on Senate Bill 1526. Not sending one, we're closing it, and once again, this bill will not be moving forward. Instead, it will be moved, the concepts will be moved into an interim work group, and we'll have continued discussions with the interim committee on its progress, meaning the work group's progress. Thank you. All right, we're going to go back to the top of the agenda. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1505. Bill? Oh, I'm sorry. Shanang? Shannon.
For the record, this is Shannon Newell. Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, this is Senate Bill 1505. This bill comes to you from the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy. We're still waiting on the fiscal impact statement for this bill, but there is no revenue statement. There are no amendments, and it has no subsequent referral. By way of background, under current Oregon law, if a member of a tribe that is not under Oregon state jurisdiction is civilly committed, that member must go to the Oregon State Hospital. There's no other option for hospitals for that member of the tribe. This bill changes that. It would allow the tribal member to go to any certified hospital or certified non-hospital facility. It would require the director of the hospital or facility or the attending physician to notify the tribe of all actions taken related to the commitment within 24 hours of those actions taken. It would direct the community mental health program director to initiate an investigation within 72 hours of admission to the hospital or facility, and it specifies that all costs would be paid by the tribe.
Thanks. All right, we have Michael Mason signed up for giving testimony. Michael, you were here before, so we appreciate you coming back now that we are having our official public hearing. If you could kind of give us an overview, I think everyone was here on Wednesday, so please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Prezanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Again, for the record, my name is Michael Mason. I'm here representing the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, who would have the primary impact of this bill. And who have you're urging the committee's support for Senate Bill 1505. The bill is a little confusing to read, perhaps, but the changes are fairly straightforward. As Council has told you, the main point for Warm Springs is to make sure that their members can be committed in accordance with the current scheme that is used by for other citizens of the state, and particularly important, as I think would be the result of the bill, that most of them would end up at St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, close to home and family. So that's really what the bill is about, not requiring that folks from Warm Springs be sent over to the state hospital. Some may end up there anyway, depending on their conditions, but we don't want to force them to be there. So I'm happy to answer questions. Again, I just emphasize that we currently, the tribal police currently transport these individuals, and the tribe bears the cost of transport and commitment. So there's no shift in this bill requirement of the tribe paying for it is still there. And I should emphasize too, though we did talk about it 2 days ago, that this primarily affects Warm Springs. It also affects Burns Paiute tribe because of the unusual jurisdiction or lack thereof on the Burns Paiute reservation as a result of retrocession of jurisdiction agreed to by Governor Atiyah when he was in office. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Michael? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 1505? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Council, I understand that we don't have the fiscal on this one.
We do not. We're still waiting.
So did you want to go ahead?
Yeah.
We're going to go ahead and open up a public, a work session on Senate Bill 1505. Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1505 without having the fiscal impact statement in hand at this time.
All right, Senator Cruz moves to suspend the rules to allow us to consider the movement and passage of Senate Bill 1505 without having the fiscal in hand. Any objection to the motion? No objection, so ordered. Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1505 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1505 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Just back to the previous motion. I'm always reluctant to move them without the paperwork, but common sense would indicate that there is no fiscal impact. That's clear and distinct, and so I'm incredibly comfortable doing that.
Senator Cruz, thank you. And I also would say, based on what we have on the record, both from our informational hearing and today, it seems to me that there should definitely not be any fiscal impact. Any other comments or discussion? If not, any objection to the motion? So ordered. And do we have a carrier for the first bill coming out? Senator Cruz will be our carrier for Senate Bill 1505 to the floor. We'll close the work session on 1505, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1524, and this looks like this one is bills.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 1524 comes to you from the Senate Judiciary Committee. And it redefines private security services to collude with the definition of private security services, individuals who control access to premises under the Oregon Liquor Control Commission if they license them. Chairman of the committee, it does not include people within this definition who are valid alcohol servers when they are not armed, not permitted to initiate confrontation or seize property, or not hired with the primary responsibility of being a bouncer. You may remember a testimony we had the other day. This would basically allow a bartender who could otherwise check for an ID inside the bar to occasionally check at the door.
All right. Thank you. We have four individuals that are scheduled to give testimony. What I'm going to do is I'll call up Bill Perry and Teresa Plummer. Won't you two please come forward first? Our next panel after this will be Andy Smith and Brenda Wilson.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association, and this may look familiar to some of you because this is the third time this committee has dealt with this particular issue, and hopefully we have it fixed this time. This was 878 last session, and there was a glitch in the drafting, and so the new bill actually has what I would say two concessions or changes from 878, which passed 56-0 on the House floor, and I think it was 26-2 on the Senate floor. And if you look at the page 2 of the bill, as Bill Taylor pointed out, the new part of it is they are required to have a valid alcohol servers permit, which is line 38, and the other one was in line 44. They added with confrontational, including physical contact, they added confiscation of property to those two things, and we were fine with that because that falls in line with what we're on. So as long as you're not doing any physical contact, you can move to the front door and check IDs. You cannot seize property. So this hopefully will fix this, and you'll never see me on this issue again. But so
Promises.
Yeah. On this issue, you'll probably see me on this kind of things. But with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Right. First, let's go hear from Teresa, please.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Plummer. I am the program manager for the private security program at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. In the interest of time, I have provided you with written testimony for your review. DPSST did participate in the work group with the interested stakeholders on this bill. We believe that the language is consistent with the intent of the proponents, and we believe that this should transition smoothly to law should it pass. And I am available for any questions if you have any.
All right, questions for either on the panel. Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think since I think I was one of the two that voted no. So and since this was an issue last time, I'm not sure. The City of Portland, are they, and I don't know if they're coming up to testify.
I think they're signing up to testify, yeah.
And does this still, if I were, I'm just recalling this from last session because I was trying to transfer my OneNote from my old computer to my new computer. Mm-hmm. As far as the training the training waivers. So did you guys, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Is this the same, that they would not have to have the same level of training? If it's like an emergency, they come and staff the door, even if they had a server's license. So can you clarify that?
Do you want to hear me? Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dinkfelder, was right. So
I think that was the issue. That was, I think, why I voted no last session.
Yeah, it, basically, if you've got a valid alcohol server's permit, you can move to the door, but then if you're required to do certain things, like if you're armed, confrontational activities, seize property, or any of those, you would need training then. As long as none of the criteria met on page 2, or I guess it bleeds over into page 3, then you would not be required to have training. So the things that are different from that bill specifically are seizing property, and the other one didn't have a requirement for an alcohol server's permit, which the alcohol server's permit, for the record, it's where you learn how to see signs of visible intoxication and check IDs. That's all part of the alcohol server. So those are the components that you'd be trained in, but you would not need the DPSST training. Does that answer your question?
So hypothetical, what happens if it's a busy night, you know, somebody who's a server goes to the door and there is, you don't know if somebody's going to be confrontational. So how would that be handled? That was, I think, the concern that I had last time, that these people didn't have the training and maybe put in that situation where they would, you know, be in a potentially confrontational interaction.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Dinkfelter. Well, and I guess that's from the experience of our owners. I mean, there's no guarantee that that won't happen. Generally, if a customer is going to be confrontational, it's our feeling that they're less confrontational if you catch them before they enter than if you get them in the establishment and try to remove them. And so generally, what would just from an experience standpoint, if somebody like tries to barge through the door, generally you just have that employee follow them, stand next to them, somebody else calls the police until they get there. But it's easier from a management standpoint to know that before they come in the establishment than trying to figure that out. So I guess the answer to your question, there's no guarantee that that wouldn't happen. But if you're asked to barricade the door, prevent them from coming in, then you need training because that's a confrontational activity. If your instructions is to follow them in and stand with them until the police get there, then you would not need the training.
I'll listen to what the city of Portland has to say.
I think you're going to hear kumbaya from what I understand from the work group, so okay. We'll see if we hear anything different.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? All right, thank you all very much. All right, Andy and Linda, please come forward. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1524?
Going to say, does this mean we won't hear it again in 2013?
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Nothing's guaranteed.
Yes. Whoever, Brenda, did you want to go first? Or
sure. It's a rhetorical question.
Good afternoon, Senator Brzezinski, members of the committee. For the record, Brenda Wilson, Intergovernmental Relations Manager for the City of Eugene. The City of Eugene participated on the work group, and we are here to sing kumbaya. We did have some concerns at the very beginning with our law enforcement personnel to address some of the same concerns that Senator Dingfelder has brought up. We worked on the work group together to address the specific issues that were coming up, and we believe that the language in the bill addresses those concerns. The intent of the language in the bill is not to do away with the requirement for DPSST training for what we typically know as bouncers. In the city of Eugene, we have some establishments that would not suffice to have someone who was not DPSST trained. This bill is not intended to do away with that requirement for those types of door people that are required in establishments that are continuously busy on a Friday or Saturday night or on a big game night. This is to provide flexibility to businesses so that if they need to post someone at the door to control access, they have the flexibility to do that. One of the requirements that we had placed in the language of the bill is that that person had to have a current server's license so that they were trained in recognizing intoxication and were trained in being able to check IDs. Again, it's not a replacement for someone to have DPSST training. It's just to allow a little bit more flexibility for those businesses that do not find themselves in the position of needing a full-time, what we would term as bouncer. And with that, I'll turn it over to Andy with the City of Portland.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. For the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to talk about Senate Bill 1524. I'd like to thank the stakeholders for working hard and in good faith to get to where we are right now. And I'd like to thank committee counsel for facilitating the process. I'd echo what Brenda said, but I'd just like to talk about some of the public safety concerns that underscored our work to get to where we are right now. In the last year, we've seen violent crimes associated with some licensed establishments in Portland, including two homicides, a forcible rape, at least one stabbing with multiple victims, and numerous gang shootings. Our police officers feel like DPSST certification has value. It precludes felons. It teaches individuals how to de-escalate confrontational situations. And it teaches individuals how to identify visibly intoxicated persons, to name a few. Regarding our intent is also not to create a loophole for establishments to hire a bartender and then put them at the front door. The language is a little bit ambiguous, so I wanted to make that clear. Our intention is to delineate between bouncers and the bartender that occasionally needs to respond to an unforeseen crowd, giving those restaurants the flexibility that they need. We think that the requirements that they can't be armed and initiate confrontational activities, initiate enforcement actions, are some good common sense safeguards that governing the scope of what they're allowed to engage in. And with that, I'll take any questions.
All right, thank you. Questions? Comments?
Thank you very much for coming forward.
Mr. Chair, I do have a quick question.
On second thought, question coming from the Senator from Portland.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both for participating in the work group. And was there any discussion about assessing, you know, how this is working and reconvening the work group to get some feedback? I mean, my only concern is that if there are problems that arise, obviously, and then, you know, we're providing this exemption, I think it would be helpful for us to get some feedback about if there's a problem. I mean, I'm still skeptical, I'll tell you, because several of those incidents have occurred in my district. So I guess I'm curious if, as far as measurable, you know, outcomes and reporting back to the work group, if there is discussion about that.
Chair Przanski and Senator Dingfelder, we didn't discuss coming back up and monitoring the situation, but I would tell you that a lot of those incidents that I mentioned occurred at places that would still be required to have DPSST certified folks at the door.
Gets my modicum of shirts.
So, well, my understanding is this is really to help facilitate where you do have an onslaught of people coming into the facility, or let's say on a temporary as-need basis, such as the person needs to be relieved to go to the facilities or whatever. It's not, as Andy said, to actually allow someone to be at the door on a day-in and day-out basis, shift-wise or whatever, on a server's license. And my understanding that there will be, I expect that there will be feedback back to us and through this whole process. If we see that being abused or not being used as the way it's supposed to, I expect that not only the cities, but also DPSST, OLCC, all of those organizations will be monitoring. And if we are seeing these type of confrontations and we find out that it's an establishment that seems to be more frequently using someone that's not properly qualified to be doing the work that they should be doing at the front, we'll hear it. And guess what? That means the bill will be back before us, but in a shape and form.
Afraid you were going to say that.
There you go. You asked for it.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very
much.
Thank you.
And again, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today? I doubt seeing anyone. We're going to close the public hearing. And I understand, Council, that this one also does not have the fiscal. And so before we move in, and we're going to go ahead and move into a work session on Senate Bill 1524.
Mr. Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of taking action on Senate Bill 1524 without having the fiscal impact statement on hand at this time.
All right. Senator Cruz moves that we suspend the rules to allow for the committee to hear Senate Bill 1524 for the purpose of sending it to the floor with a due pass recommendation, even though we currently do not have the fiscal order and paperwork in front of us today. Any discussion? Any objection? So, Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1524 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1524 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Chair will carry 1524 to the floor, and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1524. And we'll go ahead and open up our next public hearing on Senate Bill 1525. And Chenane, that's yours.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. This is Senate Bill 1525. It comes to you from the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. It has two proposed amendments, both of which would remove the original and entire language of the bill. Neither proposed amendment, dash one amendments, or proposed dash two amendments have a fiscal impact or a revenue impact. I will briefly describe these amendments for you, though you heard a little bit about it on Wednesday. Proposed dash one amendments specify that individuals employed full-time by tribal governments as public safety officers and possess certain qualifications are eligible for certification and recertification as appropriate to their qualifications. This declares an emergency and it's effective on passage. The proposed dash two amendment also replaces the original measure and specifies that on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training, the member from the FBI is a non-voting member. This also declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
All right, and on 1525, I had Marilyn Lance, why don't you come on up, please?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Marilyn Lawrence. I manage the Standards and Certification Program for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And I was up here on Wednesday at your informational meeting describing the background for the amendment that we believed was being drafted at the time to address an issue that has come up with the implementation of Senate Bill 412 regarding tribal authorized police officers. The dash one amendments were not finalized at that time. I have had a chance to review them now, and they reflect the discussions that we'd had with legislative members, with the sheriffs, with the affected tribes, and with legislative council, and we believe that they will resolve the issue that had been raised in the language of Senate Bill 412. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
All right, thank you. Question, Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Two related questions on the Public Safety Memorial Fund. What are the sources of the funding for that, the Memorial Fund? And secondly, does this legislation propose any changes in eligibility for that fund?
Chair Przanski and Senator Widsett, the source of revenue is a separate allocation from the criminal fines and assessments account. It is not part of the main portion of our agency's budget. There is a separate allocation for that. And this does not change current practice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Any other comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1525? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 1525. And I believe we have all our paperwork and everything ready for both amendments.
Yes.
So we'll go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 1525.
Do you have a question?
Oh, Senator Courtney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I assume I fully support Senate Bill 412, which is tribes bill in this measure, since there was no appearance by the sheriffs, either on Wednesday or today, that they're at least,
yes,
they do not oppose this measure, because this was a very contentious issue. I'm just trying to anticipate,
yeah,
that we're going to not get into the kind of situation we got into last session on this.
We will not. I had the opportunity to be part of a panel that was presenting on Senate Bill 412 with three of our colleagues. Sheriff Bob Wolf, who was one of the individuals that was instrumental in the discussions for the sheriffs on Senate Bill 412, came up to me and said that they were, in fact, supportive of this measure and that they were not going to be opposing it. And unless something has changed since, I believe that was on December 18th when that conference took place, I have no indication that they have changed their position. And I believe they had taken that position within about a 24, 48 hours prior to me receiving that information.
I thank you, Chair Przanski. I just wanted that on the official record.
Yep.
Thank you.
We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 1525.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 1525. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment into Senate Bill 1525.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 1525. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
I move Senate Bill 1525 as amended by the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1525 as amended by the Dash 1 and the Dash 2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And I think what we're going to do on this one is I will, let's put Senator Farioli as the carrier, and I will join him in carrying the bill and be backup if he is not available to do so. All right, with that, we'll go ahead and close that session. And what we're going to do now is go ahead and just for clarification, Senator Farioli will be our lead carrier on that bill. And then we're going to go ahead and move into our next public hearing on Senate Bill 1575.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1575 comes to you from Senator Przanski, Representative Sheehan, Representative Widener. We have the sign-up sheet here, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, but no one has signed up. Increases a penalty for disorderly conduct from a B to an A misdemeanor when a person commits disorderly conduct within 200 feet of real property in which the person knows a funeral service is being conducted. Removes from the disorderly conduct statute RS 166.025, subsection 1, subsection E, a provision the Oregon Supreme Court found unconstitutional in state for asthmas. You may remember at our informational meeting on Wednesday, the ACLU testified, as did the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. They were, I believe, neutral on the bill. They were concerned not so much about being facially unconstitutional, but being unconstitutional its application. And they were supportive of removal of the unconstitutional provision from the law.
All right, thank you. So we did have an informational hearing on this on Wednesday, and as I stated during that time, and I will state now during our public hearing, this was an attempt to accommodate some of the concerns that many of us have had as to how, let's say, individuals could in fact be disruptive at a funeral or funeral services. And what we've, after reviewing the bill that we had this last session and coming to the conclusion that it appeared that it would be ripe for challenge based on trying to somehow regulate the content of speech, we have decided that the better approach would be to apply an enhanced penalty for those who are, in fact, disorderly at a funeral service, and that's the purpose of this bill. And it will, in fact, apply to all funeral services, not to any one population or group of individuals in that means. So that's the, I think, for the record, as well as what we've heard during the informational hearing. Is there anyone else who did not sign up on the official form who would like to give testimony today on Senate Bill 1575? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And do we have the paperwork?
Chair, members of the committee, we have all the paperwork.
We're ready to go.
All right. And open up the work session, Senate Bill 1575.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1575 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1575 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes, Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to support this bill today. I do share some of the concerns that were raised about the ambiguousness of some of the words in this bill, that there was, I believe that we could clarify, I mean, words like inconvenience and annoyance are hard to define, and are somewhat subjective, and so I think that lends itself to broad interpretation. I will support this bill, but I would feel more comfortable if we had a little more assurances on this. I realize that you know, the testimony that we heard sort of shared these concerns, and I just want to put them on the record.
Yeah, and thank you. I will put on the record your comments are relating to the existing statute as it is currently law, not something that is new that's coming forward. I want to make certain that's clear on the record. So all we're really doing at this point is enhancing what the penalty potentially could be if someone was in fact convicted under the current statute for disorderly conduct, but that conduct did in fact occur within 200 feet of a funeral service, and they knew and had the intent to have that conduct impact the individuals within the 200 feet of that funeral services. Any other comments or discussion? Any objection at this time? Not seeing any, so order. And the chair will carry Senate Bill 1575 to the floor. And we'll close the work session on 1575. And we'll open up the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 201. John?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, this is Senate Concurrent Resolution 201, which is sponsored by Senator Beyer, Senator Edwards, Brzezinski, and Verger. SCR 201 recognizes and honors Eugene Police Officer Chris Kilcullen, who was killed in the line of service in 2001. He was born and raised in Eugene and was a 12-year veteran of Eugene Police Department. He's a graduate of Willamette High School in Eugene, Oregon, and a graduate of the University of Oregon. While serving with Eugene Police Department, he received over 85 awards and commendations and was twice named the Employee of the Month. He was killed, as I mentioned, in April 22, 2011, during a vehicle pursuit. He became the first Eugene Police Officer Department fatality in the line of duty in more than 70 years. Senate Concurrent Resolution 201 is here because House Bill 3039 in 2011 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to maintain and erect a sign for fallen police officers if the Legislative Assembly passes a concurrent resolution. Also in the 2011 session, you passed Senate Bill 987, which renamed Highway 126, beginning in Eugene and ending in Springfield, as Officer Chris Kilcullen Memorial Highway.
Thank you. I don't have a sign-up sheet here, but Brenda, did you want to come in?
Chair Brzezinski, there's no one signed up to testify.
All right, well, I think there is at least one individual that's going to put a little bit on the public record for us.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Members of the committee, again, Brenda Wilson with the City of Eugene. You should have some written testimony from me, but we would, on behalf of the City of Eugene and our Chief of Police, would just like to say thank you to the Lane County delegation for bringing this resolution forward, honoring Officer Chris Kilcullen. His tragic death as a result of a shooting at a traffic stop has been very sad, but at the same time really brought our community together. And again, we very quickly just like to say thank you.
All right, thank you. Anyone else who wants to give testimony today on SCR 201? Not seeing any, we'll close the public hearing and open up a work session on Concurrent Resolution 201.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 201 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves SCR 201 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We'll put Senator Beyer as the carrier on this bill. If necessary, I will be back up to Senator Beyer if he's not available. With that,
Mr. Chair, I'd say the Senate President said we got to be here every day, so I'm assuming people will be available.
we hope. But at the same time, yesterday, about 3 minutes or 5 minutes before a hearing, Senator Meyer was not able to attend. I was asked to pinch hit, so.
Okay, well, those,
things do happen. Yes, they do. All right, is there anything else, councils, that we need to cover and include for today? If not, then thank you very much for all of you for being here. We'll be adjourning for the weekend. We will be back here on Monday at 1, and the schedules will be posted before, if they're not, they're probably already posted. Yeah, okay. So they should be up and out, and we'll know where we're going. All right, with that, we're adjourned. Thank you. Everyone, safe travels if you are.